Welcome to the latest edition of March Madness Men's Basketball. I'm your host, Andy Katz. We've got a special show for you here in the final week of the regular season of men's college basketball. I'll be joined by Tom Burnett. He is the Men's Basketball Committee Chair, also the Commissioner of the Southland Conference. And we're going to go over what the committee, 12-person committee now, looks for here in the final week of the regular season. What do they take from that top 16 reveal and how they're applying it going forward as they prepare for meeting in Indianapolis next week. Obviously, he's not going to dive deep into teams. They never do that. No matter what chair, who chair, whatever, they just don't do that. So I wouldn't expect that to happen. And I'd impress them on that because they just don't do that prior to the selection. But we'll get into the weeds of the process as they prepare. Last Saturday is a great setup for this because first time ever, seven of the top 10 AP teams, Associated Press poll, lost on the same day. Now, all were on the road, but it just showed, first off, what we may see in March, that the margin of difference between these teams is very thin. And more than anything, the game is back. Great crowds all over the place. Tremendous. Look, the timing is now actually turning in our favor. Mask mandates are coming down. Limitations on crowds obviously are gone. COVID numbers are down. I fully expect we're going to have an unbelievable tournament with tremendous atmospheres. So, that's first off. And I'm going to go into my ranks and Cat's ranks about my top 10 bubble teams I'm sort of watching. And then the back part of the podcast, special interview for you. I caught up with three players from San Francisco. The Dons are in our bracket. And our bracket, by the way, you can check out at NCAA.com on Tuesday, NCAA Digital, our first bracket of the month of March. And in that bracket is USF. On USF, three players from that region, from the region that is dominating the headlines in the world. Volodymyr Markovetsky is from the Ukraine. And his two teammates, Yawen Mazalski and Dmitry Ryunyi, they are both from Belarus. Belarus is helping the Russians against Ukraine. Yet, you listen to the three of them, they're brothers, they're teammates. Country matters, but there isn't a difference with them. And you just wish that governments could be like teams. And basketball's done a great job of bringing people together. So it's powerful. What's happening in the Ukraine is horrific, tragic, and hopefully will end soon. So I want you to hear that interview. This is going to be a storyline, obviously, with this team going forward as they go into the WCC tournament, hopefully the NCAA tournament. It's a storyline for all of us, of course, anywhere on the globe. So that's coming up as well. Let's start off, though, with Tom Burnett. And joining me now, Tom Burnett, the commissioner of the Southland Conference and the chair of the NCAA Men's Basketball Selection Committee. And Tom, this is the final week of the regular season for most of the teams in Division I. A number of other conferences are going to start their conference tournaments later this week. And then obviously next week, Champ Week, Selection Sunday. And looking forward to seeing you obviously in Indianapolis over those days. So on Saturday, first time ever, seven of the top 10 teams in the AP all went down, now all on the road. And it was historic, but at the same time, it didn't probably change a lot. In general, this is a couple weeks now after the top 16 reveal. What did it tell you when you see that sort of carnage of the top seven in the AP poll all going down on the road?
Well, I'll say this, Andy. I'm glad we didn't do the bracket reveal this past Saturday because yes. What would have happened? But, I think that just like anyone else, certainly amazed to see the results and, unprecedented in that top six or seven. I think what I would recognize is people seem to forget, as much as we admire kind of the top part of this group of teams, there's still a lot of parity out there. And then also, too, I would acknowledge, you know, conference play is hard. We've said that before, and especially it's really hard on the road. And when you look at these teams that went on the road and lost, that by itself is not so surprising. Certainly the alignment of it all happening on this one day, you know, certainly, you know, probably surprised a lot of us, but it's part of what we do. It just, I guess we couldn't wait to get to March to have the madness. We had to have a little bit in February as well.
So to peel it back a little, what does it take? And we're going to use that. I want to use that top 16. So that particular day, you know, we had Gonzaga, Arizona, Auburn, and Kansas. Those were the four number ones. When you're doing this process, so from that point, you know, through next week, what does it take to move a team off of a line of where you had projected them or where you may think that they should be?
Well, I think what we'd want people to know is we're going to start that process all over again. We're not going to revert back to that top 16 reveal as a basis for what we do. Certainly, there'll be some comparisons after the fact and how good, perhaps, or honest was that top 16 reveal or what it looks like a few weeks later. But we're going to start the process all over again. You know, when we convene next week, you know, next Wednesday, we will really submit our initial ballot. And that's the same thing we did last week when we did the reveal. So it starts all over again. We start from scratch, so to speak. And moving a team off of one line or what based on the top 16 really doesn't apply.
You know, the overall body of work, we've heard that term forever. How much value is put in to those road neutral games versus a home win over even a legitimate top five, top 10, top two team?
Well, you're not going to ignore any result, but I think certainly that the committee and, you know, not just now, but in previous years has acknowledged that winning on the road can be a big difference maker when you get down to the final selection, certainly, or you're trying to determine, you know, who's that four seed, who's that five seed, whatever it might be. So certainly don't want to lessen the idea that winning on the road is anything less for the committee, although we certainly recognize winning at home against prominent teams is an outstanding accomplishment as well. So it's all part of that, you know, again, as we do say, the entire body of work, and we're going to take all those factors into play.
So I've adopted, obviously, the quad one, quad two vernacular. And, you know, I'm just also curious, and I know you can't, maybe you can, I mean, dive specifically into some teams, but the bottom line is, if a team has, let's say hypothetically, five or six or even seven quad one wins, quad one, but they've got some baggage in the past, you know, a couple of bad losses that happened in November, December, how do you balance, you know, those two entities on a sheet that you're looking at, where when they are at their best, they can beat the best teams versus, you know, earlier in the year when they either, you know, had issues, what have you, lost to some bad teams?
Well, I think it all comes down to 12 of us as committee members coming to our independent conclusions on what those mean. And certainly we have mentioned quite a bit, you know, the quads within the net. And nothing in my time on the committee has been determined strictly by net, but the net rankings allow us to dig a little bit deeper into those quads. And certainly there are going to be some teams that, you know, are going to have some great wins, but then also maybe some questionable losses. They could have been early. They could be here in the last week or so. And again, you try to rid yourself of certainly any recency bias, but there's also an opposite of that. You don't want to get too caught up in maybe how they did in November versus how they did this week. But it's all in that mix of things. And again, independently, we'll all come to a conclusion on where we think these teams reside. And then in the more open discussion, when we get into scrubbing, you know, talking about seeding and all of that, that will come out in the mix there.
You know, the other thing too is, and I've said this on air, when I reference a conference record, and I know all conference records are not equal, especially in leagues that don't play true round robin, or in this year where some of these leagues aren't playing a full schedule because of cancellations. But when I say, you know, I think a team needs to be 11-9 or 12-8, that's knowing that within that 11 or 12 wins, they are quad one or quad two, that you can't just beat up on the bottom. How much do you, when you see those records, do you really have to peel it back and say, okay, how did they get to 12 wins in the Big 10, the Big 12, you know, ACC, you name it, versus just this great record within a league?
Well, the other thing about conference play, Andy, is, as you know, is that you really can't control that. You know, that schedule is set, you know, by your conference office, and you just have to play it, you know, as it lies, so to speak. You know, but there is a recognition that, you know, there might be some uneven scheduling. You mentioned the COVID cancellations. I think optimistically here, I know we're going to miss out on some matchups, but it looks like most of those games have been, you know, made up. So we feel pretty good about that. But I think certainly through our conference monitoring program, we're going to be fully aware of those teams that may not have played certain teams in their conference. We're going to dig a little bit deeper and ask why and what was the case there. But a lot of that falls back on how the conference arranged the schedule for their teams. And, you know, that's really out of their control.
Back part of the bracket gets a lot of talk at this time of the year and in Champ Week. And then sort of we go back to the top of the bracket with the favorites. What are you looking at when you're voting for that last group of eight or four? And that's the other thing, too. I just want to clear. I mean, I've gone through the process, but if we could just clarify for those that don't remember that you're not necessarily saying, OK, here's the last team in. It's Team X versus Team Y, that it's a collection of teams that are voted. If you just, you know, clear that up in terms of how that back of the bracket, the first four teams. So those last four to eight teams get put into the field.
Yeah, a great question. And as you're aware, Andy, we have a fourth quadrant subcommittee of the entire committee that works on a group of teams through the season, certainly as we get into late January, into February and March. So they're already focused and have been meeting on a collection of teams that, you know, whether it's the committee or others in the basketball world are looking at as, you know, those last teams in. Now, I will say this, ultimately, that's not a decision by the subcommittee. That will be the entire committee making the decisions, just like we would on the top, you know, first quadrant, the top four seed line. So that's going to be something that, you know, we're all going to be involved with, but we do have a little bit of a head start with our great fourth quadrant committee that works on that. So we're going to have a pretty good idea even before we get to some of those, you know, last decisions on Saturday night of selection weekend. So that's been very helpful, I know, in my time on the committee.
But how does that ranking work? Like you say, okay, you know, we're down to the 11 line or the 12 line. How does it, just so we educate people, how does it work where you're ranking those teams to then ultimately fill those last spots?
Well, I don't know that it's any different than what we do at the very top of the line. So it's the same process. We're bringing them in. We're opening up the discussion. We're going through the scrubbing process as well as, you know, once they're set on those seed lines. And as you're aware, we'll be scrubbing almost from the very beginning. We'll be scrubbing the top quadrant, that second quadrant, third quadrant. We'll be doing that throughout. So it's the same process throughout, whether you're on the number one seed line or maybe even on the 13 seed line. We're going to go through that with our due diligence.
And these are terms that we hear at this time of the year. How do you define scrubbing?
Well, scrubbing is really just a head-to-head comparison. When we look at teams on those seed lines, you know, the number one seeds, we'll take as an example, we will scrub every one of those teams against one another. We will ask the committee, is there anything you see here or you want to talk about that may think this team jumps that one or this team may need to drop? So that goes throughout the week once we get into really setting the very first seed lines at the beginning of our process. We may go through, you know, maybe a dozen and a half scrubbing processes through the tournament. We'll do that again even when we get together on Sunday, presuming we have a pretty good idea of what the seed list can look like late Saturday night.
All right, last two things, Tom, and I appreciate your time. How do you define a bid stealer?
Oh, gosh, we've seen that before. Certainly, there are usually bid stealers that are kind of lying in wait at conference tournaments. And certainly, you don't want to put everything on one game. Again, we're referring to the entire body of work. But certainly, we see teams that we think might need one more check mark on their resume to get into the tournament. And then something happens at their conference tournament. And certainly, we, as we've seen before, you know, we have contingencies on finals Sunday there with all the five tournaments that are going on. So those conference tournaments certainly can be dangerous to some teams.
All right, last thing, Tom, I know you're going to start fresh, but that was a good primer with the top 16. What did you see in compiling that top 16 that you think will translate to the real deal in terms of, you know, hard decisions as you build those top four lines?
Well, I think my takeaway, Andy, is that, you know, we've got an expanded committee, as you're aware. We have five new members. I think there was maybe some question or concern, perhaps, that with five new members, I think for the first time ever, how would we work through that process? And I will tell you, our five new members really locked in, handled it beautifully, and just moved through the process. So I'm really confident that we're going to be able to move through it next week, and not rapidly, but through the normal process. But we've got a very engaged committee. They're going to come to the table very well informed, and I just believe we're going to be in a great spot next weekend.
Well, look forward to it. Finally get to see you guys in person. It's been a couple of years. So look forward to seeing everyone in Indianapolis. Appreciate it, Tom. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy.
Andy Katz, that guy will rank his wife's dinners. He'll rank anything.
All right, time for Katz Ranks here on March Madness Men's Basketball. My top 10 teams on the bubble that I'm really looking to track over the next week and a half. Let's start number one, Rutgers. We've been pretty consistent here. I think the Scarlet Knights need to get to 11 or 12 wins in the Big Ten to get into the NCAA tournament, because those wins would be, that would give them 6 or 7 quad one wins. So they're number one. Two, TCU. Two games against Kansas this week. They just beat Texas Tech. They're a very intriguing team to get in the tournament. Three, Indiana. Good road win. They've had a couple good road wins. And this Indiana team has the talent to be in the tournament. You got a big game coming up at home against Rutgers, then at Purdue. I feel like they got to get one more. If they lose these two, they're going to have to do work in the Big Ten tournament. Four, Virginia Tech. The Hokies. They need more quad one wins. It's going to be hard to get them. They have to advance in the ACC tournament, but I think they're there. They're getting closer. Five, Loyola Chicago. Looking like a team that we thought would be in no matter what, but then they didn't win the Valley. They lost to Northern Iowa. So now the Ramblers are the fourth seed in the Valley. So that's what we don't know yet about Loyola Chicago. Track how they do in Arch Madness. Three quad one wins. Six, North Texas. They've won 14 in a row. They won Conference USA running away. What happens if they don't win that tournament? I think they should get in. They've had a phenomenal season. Seven, BYU. Four quad one wins, but that Pacific loss really stings. I think BYU absolutely has to get to the semifinal, losing really only to St. Mary's or Gonzaga. I mean, based on at some point in that tournament. The Cougars, you know, clearly they have work to do. And they had a chance, and that's the problem, and they didn't convert. So looking at the bracket, they have to play in a first-round game, or second round. They're going to play the winner at Pacific LMU. Then they would get San Francisco, so they got to win that game, and then they play Gonzaga. Do they have to beat Gonzaga? I guess now that I look at the bracket, maybe they don't have to, but they got to get to that game. Absolutely have to get to that game. Because then the other side of the bracket, you'd have St. Mary's, would play probably Santa Clara, maybe Portland. So I think BYU has to be in that game, which would mean they'd have to beat San Francisco. Eight, Florida. The Gators, they've got that Ohio State win. Got to do more work in the SEC tournament for sure. Nine, Oregon. Had a chance to get 4-0 against the LA schools. Lost in the last possession of USC and Drew Peterson. So they're intriguing. They have more work to do. But I ultimately think they can get in and win a game or two. And 10, VCU. 1-7 in a row. I think they should be in as of now, but they probably need to get minimum to the semis of the A-10 tournament, maybe the final. But they need to get in. especially, a little biased here, but they were the only team last year that did not get a chance to play in the NCAA tournament. They were the one team who had a COVID issue that they arrived with. They didn't play their game against Oregon, and they left. The only team. If the basketball gods are looking down at VCU, they get in and have an opportunity to play in the NCAA tournament in 2022. All right, that'll wrap up this edition of Cats Ranks. And now joining me here on March Madness Men's Basketball on NCAA Digital, three players from the University of San Francisco, one of the teams that we're going to be talking about, certainly in the Field of 68. I'm very confident that they will be in the NCAA tournament. Had a great year in the West Coast Conference. But I want to go a little big picture, obviously, in what is happening in the world that is more important, obviously, than basketball. And I'm joined by Volodymyr Markovetsky. He is from the Ukraine, and his teammates, Dmitry Yunyi and Yaoyan Mazalski, both from Belarus. Volo, I want to start with you about just what this has been like. You're all the way in San Francisco as you're watching reports of what is happening in your native land in Ukraine.
I'll tell my little story. So right before all this situation, like this guy can prove this, everybody in the team and all the team asked me about this situation, about Russian-Ukraine conflict. And every time I say, like, I don't believe it. Like, I can imagine, I can believe, like, Russia attack Ukraine. Like, I believe in only good things. So one day after the practice, I go to the library, do my homework, back at home. And then coach called me, like, what happened in Ukraine? I said, like, nothing. Like, everything, like, the same. And then, like, for another 20 minutes, another coach call me and have like exactly the same question. I start a little bit nervous, worries about my family. And then like, okay, I'm calling to my mom because I know it's like 5 a.m. in Ukraine. So I just want to call because it's like super early at this time. But I do like whatever. It's like maybe really something happened. And then I call to my mom and first thing what I hear is she crying and telling me Russia attacked us. And like in this moment, I really lose myself. I just like something broke inside me. I don't know how react to this information because how I say, I believe only in good things. I can't even imagine that this can happen. But after this, I was like, okay, my city is like opposite side of all like this situation. Like my Ukraine, like my city close to the Poland. It's like from Kiev, it's like 8 hours driving with a car. And like from Donetsk and Lugansk, it's like almost like a day of travel. I think, okay, if like Russia attack Ukraine, my family, my home is like super away from this place. I talk with my mom, I try to say like everything will be fine. Like I try to build her, like it was super. And then I call to my father, call to my Ukrainian friends, ask him like how they feel, and then I say okay, everything will be fine. Hour after, I called to my mom again, like to ask like okay, how my sister doing, like how she doing, and she told me like the airport in my city just destroyed. And airport is like 10 minutes from my home. And I saw the video how it's happened, just bomb fly correctly to the airport. The people's scary and all this stuff. And after this, I imagine like I'm wrong again. Can't believe the Russian attack Ukraine. I don't believe it's somehow affect my city. And I run twice. And after this, I start really worried about my family. Because I'm in this moment, I really understand like it's not a joke.
How is your family as we're talking here on Monday? How are they?
So my mom and my sister 11 years old, they crossed the border 2 days ago. Right now they're in Lithuania. They're in good hands, they're in safety.
Which border?
Lithuania.
Lithuania comes. So my father, because he worked in police, he can leave Ukraine and because of job. Right now he's in a public safety patrol. He patrol the city every day from 10 hours. They have AK-47. They have like all the military equipment, and every day he controlled the city like 10 hours. Right now, like, I worry about him because his life is dangerous, but I'm most worried because of his mental health. Because my mom, my family leave the house because of safety. Like, can you imagine, like, today, like, in the world we're living, that my family leave the home because it's dangerous, because they can, like, really die. How crazy it is. My father stay for just to fight his home. Like, come on, it's crazy.
So, Yao and Dmitry, you're both from Belarus. Not to get mired in the politics of this, but we know Belarus has been helping Russia. So how have you, both of you, dealt with your emotions on this? You have nothing to do with the governments, but still, how have you dealt with dealing with Volo and being a good friend and a teammate with everything that's going on back in your country?
Regarding my position, I haven't lived there for the last 7 years. And, now my position becomes clearer and clearer why I didn't do it, you know. And for the safety of our families in this situation, we cannot say, you know, we can say the emotional stuff, we can say what really you think about stuff like that. But the point of that is what is going on is really, it's scary. We had some kind of a situation, of course, not even close to similar to war a year ago with our elections, when the people were just taken from their houses to go to jail just to express their opinions. And that's the freedom of words, you know? But in reality, you know, right now, especially the Belarusian military forces are being sent to die. And the people who I knew, who we were playing with, who we were growing up with, are sent to their certain death in that situation. And just as a scare, like how scary it is. And, you know, Vova tried to, like, from even just sitting right next to him right now and just hearing those things. And, you know, he tells you this first time, we're hearing this the whole time. We can read, you know, the news that coming from there. And this is one of the hardest things where nobody should ever experience what exactly he's going through. As much as we know how people want to sympathize him and how much we do, the experience of this is something that none of us ever should experience.
Dmitry?
Yeah, adding to Yagan's point, I had a chance to go home in summer to visit my family because the whole COVID-19 situation for the last year and a half, I didn't have a chance to go home last summer. So I got a chance to go this summer. And from personal experience, I wouldn't say that it was as safe back home as it ever been before, pre-war the war. But especially now, I can agree with Volo. At first, I didn't believe the fact that Russia actually attacked Ukraine, because I'm partially Ukrainian, my dad is from Ukraine. And I have half of my family living in Ukraine and the other part live in Belarus. Mom's side live in Belarus and dad's in Ukraine. So at first, I didn't believe it too. So I called my dad and I asked him, like, is it true? At first, he wasn't even knew the whole situation himself. So only like after two days after, we can actually figure out that we actually were. And it's just really hard to express, like, how I was scared for my family, for my both sides of the families. But like going back to the Belarus part, I was really proud of Bill Belarusian at first, but now, like, I don't understand, like, why would we be part of this and, like, helping Russia, or, like, open our border, or, like, I'm confused, like, why would we, like, attacking our brothers? Because we've been brothers with Russia for, like, as long as I know myself, and I never had any political or any type of issue with them. So it's just really hard to understand and accept.
You know, the three of you, I think, are a great example of how sports, especially basketball, as we've seen internationally, brings people together. You could all be from different backgrounds. Your governments could have different conflicts. But at the human level, person to person, you get along, you're teammates. Do you ever wonder, like, why can it exist in this form, but not in others, especially at the governmental level?
I will say we have revolution, like 2014. And when Belarus revolution happened, me and only everybody in Ukraine feel the pain of Belarus people, how hard it is. And except I know my mom support Belarus so much in this time. She helped, my father helped, everybody I know, like, they really like crying for Belarus. And right now in this situation, I feel like the same. maybe we have like some political conflict between all these countries. While like people, we, how Dmitry say, we are brother. The people are connected between Ukraine and Belarus in Russia. Like, no one want to fight. No one want war. But everything what I want to politics, say to politics, like you need the standards. Because only Ukrainians and only you can stop this. People don't want to work.
And as you said it very correctly, and Dima and Bola, people are brothers. We don't want to fight with each other. But we are, like, of course, we can sit here in San Francisco and say all that, but we have our families, our friends there, and they are suffering, and we're suffering with them. And we, in our generation, we're not responsible for the broken system of 20 years ago. We're just not. So stop the war, fix this thing. It's not right. And not a single person will tell you that it's right. And who will say, it's not a quiet, smart person.
Yeah, people don't deserve to die just because of political conflict of two powerful leaders. People are supposed to be victims of this situation. There's supposed to be another way to solve this issue in a peace way. So all I can say is ask, is just please stop the war.
The blue and yellow flag that's hanging behind you, what does it mean to you?
For me, it's home. For me, it's my family. I left Ukraine at such a young age of 13. Every day, I think about Ukraine because my family lives right there. I'm born in Ukraine. It's my culture. It's my home. For me, it's everything. My family, my father, they fight for Ukraine. I will fight for Ukraine. And my kids will fight for Ukraine because it's our home.
And lastly, the three of you, and I really appreciate you taking some time here. What has the staff, you know, Todd Golden and the staff and the community of your team and the school, if you could each answer this, just what it has meant to you during this unbelievable, stressful time in what should be, as I said at the top, you know, a celebrated time as you're getting close to potentially being in, you know, in the NCAA tournament as the season is winding down. If you could just go down the line, you know, Yaoyan, Volo, and Dmitry.
I think the most important part is that everybody here cares. You know, and as you said, it's the time of celebration. You know, you have most important games, you have the end of the season and all that stuff coming up together. And just understanding that the staff is here for you and they would do everything in their power to help you to get through it. And as experience is that what I'm seeing for them doing towards Boa, and I've been here, you know, for a long time in WCC in general, not a lot of people would be as invested as this place is. And from my perspective, I'm really grateful for that, for what they do for him. And it's been awesome. A lot more work to be done, though.
And to Jorgen's point, as he said, it's a very diverse place. So there's a lot of people from different cultures. And for them to understand the situation that all of our countries in right now, I really appreciate that. For them showing support and being caring and showing their love and support and donating money and doing all those little things that can actually probably not fix, but like improve situation in some type of way. So I'm just really grateful for them being understanding.
So I feel huge support this moment. Everybody, like coaches, players, students, teachers, even like just people who know like from Ukraine. I have like everyday messages that people ask me, do I need some help? And they really want to help me, help my family, help Ukraine. And everything I can say just, thank you for all this support. Like, it's really important for me. Like, I know, like, maybe I don't need support, but my family is in Ukraine needs support. So for all these people who want to help, I say thank you so much. And for people who want to help somehow, please, if you can, any support in this crazy time.
Well, we wish your father, obviously, safety as he patrols the streets there, and your mom and your sister, hopefully you're safe in their hopefully temporary location. Thinking of all three of you, you're doing a wonderful thing being a team and really helping Volo get through this. And hopefully it will end sooner than later. Appreciate your time, guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you.
And that'll wrap up this edition of March Madness Men's Basketball. As always, go to @MarchMadnessMBB for all our content. NCAA Digital, of course. So last week of the regular season, next week leading into Champ Week, and then Selection Sunday, March 13th. Well, of course, a bracket breakdown with our podcast leading into the NCAA tournament. As always, big shout out to Abby Stoltz, team at Bleacher Report, everyone at NCAA.com doing a great job with the pod. Appreciate everyone's hard work getting this to you. Thanks for listening, everyone. Take care.